Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswami. We're here living in the light. Let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Dearest Swamiji, help us to attune ourselves to your living consciousness. Show us the way to be disciples, to serve this ray, to live in the light, to open our hearts, releasing all delusions and fears, that we may be pure channels of thy perfect love to all. Om, peace. Amen. It's now the end of October, since the middle of March 2020. I've been in very restricted lifestyle. In and of itself, it's not that hard for me, fortunately. You might be surprised to hear, but I'm somewhat introverted. And I don't mind being alone, and I don't mind just entertaining myself, except for moments. But I have really become aware of how much enormous positive benefit we get from satsang with each other, being with each other. And since that's been the whole subject of this brochure that I've been reading of Swamiji's for the last so many weeks, about the power of attuning with each other, the power of not being on our own, of working together spiritually. Heavens, I mean, the little bit of restriction that we've had for this little period of time is just hardly a blip on the radar of life. But it has served in a very deep and a really touching way to help me to appreciate how much interaction with people and being in the company of others and serving together is really like a vitamin on the spiritual path, and a certain deficiency sets in if you're accustomed to having it. Fortunately, the internet has given us lots of ways to be together without being in physical proximity, and that definitely helps. But I do feel that one of the results of this experience, assuming that it ends in such a way that we can go back to more normal relations, it's going to be a very, very deep gratitude. And anything that increases our gratitude is always for the good. This is how life works. We get the opportunity constantly to become more sensitively aware of our blessings. And as we become more aware of all the ways that we're blessed, correspondingly, the ways that we have appeared to suffer seem either minimalized in our actual perception of them or totally forgotten, because they don't have the power to take away our happiness that our blessings have to give us our happiness. These are so commonly spoken that they rise to the level almost of aphorisms, or you might even say cliches. But the reason things are repeated is because they have truth to them. And when we begin to experience it, we really know. This coming week in the Nanda Palo Alto community where I live, of course, we're having an auction. And as part of that, the people in charge, Keshava and others, have created this wonderful little skit that was filmed. And observing healthful protocol almost completely, we broke it a little, but not much. They managed to film the skit to be presented, and it's quite fun. It's pure fluff, but it's quite fun. But just the opportunity to do something together, it was so rejuvenating. And then later, Keshava said to me that after the last Sunday service, they're cleaning the carpets in the temple, and the tech staff that's there on Sundays, which is kind of a family bubble, because the quarantine restrictions for all of them are the same. They all just moved the chairs out of the temple. And again, he commented to me, it was just so rejuvenating just to do something with other people. Many things that we take for granted, I hope that deprivation will sweeten our appreciation, simplify our expectations and sweeten our appreciation. That's what God is always wanting us to do, is to feel more deeply the bliss of his presence without requiring enormous structures in order for that to be awakened within us. Simple living and high thinking is how Master put it, that happiness comes from simplifying. So this situation has forced us to simplify, and God willing, we'll hold to that and really treasure what is deeply dear to us. The other thing that's been happening just for me in the last few days, just to chat since I am here, on the 21st of October, I'm starting a several months long course, which is a sort of a virtual pilgrimage to Israel. We went last January and did two pilgrimages, and I've been to Israel four times in the last several years, five times, one, two, three, four times. And we were going to go again in January, but of course everything's closed. I have one of the biggest difficulties in pilgrimage to the Holy Land is the crowds of other pilgrims. And I can't help but wish there was some way I could sneak into Israel right now, because there's no one there. And just, you know, to go place to place and have it all to yourself. But of course, this can't be done. But it occurred to me that we could walk where Jesus walked in a what they call a virtual way, but meaning just by sharing the experience. And when you travel geographically, you have to do it in a certain way. But I realized if we're doing it virtually, we're not bound by geography. So we can do the life of Christ in a chronological way. I mean, starting even from before his birth with Elijah and Elisha, previous incarnations of John the Baptist and Jesus, and through the angel coming to Mary. And so I've been working on that, just pulling the ideas together and the music and some photographs of the places. And it was just interesting to me, because when I was praying, and you know, we always say the names of the gurus, but when I say Jesus Christ, because I've been, over the last few days, I've been walking with him in my heart again, going and seeing all those spots, there's just like all of a sudden those words mean something entirely different. Because these are living presences, and when we say the so-called name of such a person, what we're actually doing is invoking the vibration. So I do hope, this is a paid class to help support Ananda Palo Alto. If you're part of Patreon, which is something we've just started, one of the perks of Patreon is that paid classes are free for you. Patreon is a way to support creative people to do what they're doing. In our case, the mission of the masters. But also it just, the experience, just the little tiny bit of the way the words Jesus Christ sound different to me when I pray, just with this little bit of preparation, puts me in mind again of everything that Swami's writing about. And that we've been talking about this ray of grace, this special dispensation that has come, and the power that's there, the blessings at hand, as Swami calls them, is remarkable to all who received him. I mean, there's the promise. It's really entirely up to us. And it's always so fascinating to me how the vrittis of karma, we know where our greatest happiness lies, and then the vrittis of karma just spin us out. And by the grace of God, my karma has settled to a certain point at this stage of my life. It was more tempestuous when I was younger, but it's settled. But it's still as intense as it needs to be to keep me on my toes. And every time I drift from a clean focus, and then am pulled back to that clean focus. The heart and mind always says, why do I ever wander? Why do I ever even wander a millimeter away from that clean focus? But that's the great mystery of life, isn't it? That's Arjuna's question to Krishna, which is why, again and again, against one's own will, are we driven to do things that we know are not going to give us our greatest happiness? And, you know, Krishna says, desire and anger. Desire it is. And then it goes on, anger is a further extension of desire. But desire leads us, desire thwarted leads us to anger. Anger leads us to the loss of discrimination. But there it is. I just, somehow the experience of these last months, which is barely rises to the level of an inconvenience. I say that because sometimes there's an inclination to complain about circumstances. I found myself not too long ago, just like a petulant child saying, I want our church to be open. And it was just, that was just a true expression of my heart. I want to see my friends. I want to be in the company of other people. I want to share worship and satsang with devotees. And just, like that. But there are real problems in the world. I mean, many people who have been going through this experience are facing serious financial challenges and breaking down of health or death of themselves or loved ones. I mean, there are real problems in this world, and I'm not experiencing any of them. I mean, this is barely an inconvenience, and not even that, really, on a very deep level. So I don't want to be misunderstood here, but it has highlighted for me the extraordinary mystery of Maya, how Maya just persists, and it just persists until we're done with it. Swamiji tells the story of Sadhu Haridas, who was a very great saint, a very great saint. He could walk on water. He could do miracles. He's the one who was talking to the Christian missionaries, and he was in a boat, and he said, what makes your Jesus Christ so special? And they said, well, he could walk on water. And Sadhu Haridas said, really, is that all? And then he stepped off the boat and walked on water, and everywhere he went, the boat was compelled to follow him, and then he gets back in the boat. So there was no question about the magnitude of his spiritual realization. But at a certain point, he became attracted to a woman. He left his ashram. He went off to be with that woman for a period of time. It wasn't clear to me whether it was months or years, but it was a period of time. And then he realized that the attraction was not really the life he wanted to follow. He repudiated it. He came back to his ashram. His disciples accepted him again, recognized that he had repudiated his error, and he became realized. He became completely free. It's just like, you know, we stand on the edge and are so exceedingly judgmental. When Swami Kriyananda was sued, attacked in that incredibly dishonest lawsuit that was known as the Bertolucci lawsuit, which was an extension of the religious persecution, it was another attempt to discredit Ananda and to give a monopoly on Master's teaching to someone else. And it failed. But in the course of it, Swamiji said, yes, you know, I was initiated as a monk at the age of 22, after frankly telling Master that the sexual energy was still a part of my consciousness, and Master made me a monk, and he accepted it. And Swami said, frankly, that, you know, that energy still attracted him, although he was very clear to state. He said, it wasn't really sexuality per se. And he said, and his phrase was, and I was never obsessed with it. He said, the fact that the thought lingered at all in my mind was deeply disturbing to me. And then he said, he had been so vilified and rejected by his guru bhais and those he cared about and respected most deeply, that he had a longing for human comfort, is how he put it, for sympathy and comfort. And for a man, women are often where that sympathy and comfort seems to come from. As he said, he also had the illusion that somehow women were fundamentally different from men, and that because women tended to manifest the feminine side of creation, that women were inherently more sympathetic in some sense. And then when he would say this, he laughed ruefully and said, "Divine Mother really disciplined me on that thought, because Swami suffered greatly at the hands of females. Most of the persecution against him took place from women." And so he got over that. But what I found most very interesting, because there were so many interesting factors in all of this, was how glib people were about what it means to actually liberate yourself from delusion. And people were just so quick to define what it meant. Master said to Swamiji about that very desire, he said, "This is not deep in you. You will overcome it." Because at one point, Swami said to Master, "I'd rather commit suicide. I'd rather die. I'd rather kill myself than give in to this kind of energy." Master sort of dismissively said, "Oh, why speak of suicide?" He said, "It's not deep in you. You'll overcome it." So it was like, why are you taking this so seriously? But the other side of it is, what does it really mean to transcend this energy? I mean, really transcend this energy. I mean, it's one thing to restrain yourself. It's quite another to transcend the delusion altogether. And that's what Swami said by the end of the Bertolucci lawsuit, and before that, actually before. He said, much before. He said, the thought just doesn't arise. It's just not there anymore. I mean, think about that. The thought doesn't arise. And there are a number of great souls who Swami has told us a few stories about, very, very great saints, Sadhu Haridas only being one of them, who yet still have something that they have to go through in terms of what is the strongest impulse in the human being after self-preservation. So what does freedom from this actually look like? You know, we have this Kali Yuga, this is what it looks like, but I think it's far more nuanced, and I have to just use the word far more interesting than that. Just far more interesting. And I'll go back to, you know, the subject that we may or may not actually talk about today. This is where Swami talks about the need to attune ourselves to people who are more advanced than us. And not merely to attune ourselves, but to actually pay attention. Now, it is true that I had a particular relationship with Swami Kriyananda. It was unhesitating, but not unquestioning. And that's how Swami described himself in relation to Master. And I freely and openly adopt that, because that is how I was, am. I had limitless respect and regard for Swami Kriyananda, which was never disappointed, but I also had a fairly high regard for myself. I mean, not in a negative sense, although it can and has. I pray it still doesn't, but it doesn't now, but it can and it has veered over to what was unwholesome. But there was a part of it that was simply wholesome, which is I trust my own experience and I stand by it. So when things that Swamiji would suggest to me contradicted my own experience, I wasn't capable of just acquiescing. I mean, to the point sometime that I remember only once did Swami really become impatient with me. And he said, when I was disputing something he wanted to do, he said, "Asha, I know you're going to agree with me in the end, so why don't you just stop arguing now?" And that was the only time I ever remember that he actually reprimanded me for my way of being. But I did. I pushed and on many different issues, I would say later, I tried as hard as I could to dissuade him, and he wouldn't be dissuaded. Some were important, some were small. But I would present my ideas until I had exhausted them. But I also did, I came to do, as soon as I started doing this, everything got better. I would reverse engineer what Swami did. That's a phrase I learned somewhere, and I think it's appropriately applied. What that means, I heard it first in terms of the rumors that UFOs had crashed in New Mexico, and that a great deal of modern technology was actually, they reversed engineered from the advanced technology they found on the crashed UFOs and figured out how they created what they created, and then went back and recreated some of it. I have no idea if that's true, but the concept stuck with me. So I would think this way, you know, Swamiji has manifested to me an extraordinary expanded state of spiritual realization. And this is what he's saying. This is what he's suggesting. This is what he himself has done or is doing. So how can that be consistent with expanded consciousness? Now, other people would do it the other way. I thought Swami had expanded consciousness. Now he has said or done this. Therefore, he doesn't have expanded consciousness. I worked the other way. I know that he does because I trust my own experience. I've experienced his consciousness. So if with that consciousness he's behaving this way, then what don't I understand about expanded consciousness? Because really, friends, how could I understand it? I'm clever, but I'm not realized. So if somebody whose realization is self-evidently greater than mine feels that this is, or is compelled, or whatever it might be, does this, then what am I missing? Where have I misunderstood? Now, I know that can sound like just sort of like blind obedience and fitting everything in, but it's not. That's the only thing I can say, it's not. Because in every single instance, when I would reverse engineer it, I would always understand something more deeply, more clearly, more vividly, and more accurately than I had understood it when I was just imposing my limited ideas and refusing to accept their limitations. Now, all of this is exactly what Swamiji is talking about when he says attuning ourselves, you know, making associations and attuning ourselves with those who have greater consciousness, who are more in tune with the path than we are, who are more advanced, more experienced, however you want to call it, more experienced on the path. I know I've said this on many occasions, but really, I don't know where I would be without the example, the friendship, and the opportunity to test my ideas, at least with my peers, and on many, many situations, with people who are more advanced, Seva and Jyotish particularly, who were Swamiji's right and left hand for many years of Ananda. And Jyotish, of course, has been named Swami's successor with his wife, Devi, and they serve in that capacity. These were my friends, all of them. And I would have the chance to say, this is what I'm thinking, and they would have the chance to say, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly accurate. And, you know, those were unique circumstances. I've been reading this book about Russian saints. It's called Everyday Saints, I think it's called. I'll have to find the exact name and present it now that I've mentioned it. But this is a modern book about Russian Orthodox monks. And he talks about the joy of the novitiate, the first years in the monastery. And he articulates it absolutely perfectly to me. I've never heard it articulated perfectly, because that's what my first 10 years at Ananda was. It was a novitiate. It was this time of celebration to have found my spiritual path, and celebration on such a level that even though, of course, there were many hard experiences during those years, how could there not be? The celebration of putting my feet on the path in that youthful, joyous way was greater than anything else that ever happened. When Swami and I were talking about reincarnation, I said, oh, I can relive those first 10 years again in a heartbeat. Swami, and because we were talking about desire bringing you back. Oh, he said, that's different. That's a desire for liberation, which is not a binding desire. But what was so touching, I read in the monk's book that I saw in Swami and I pray to see in myself. At the end of life, one can return to that, where the celebration of living for God, living in the light, transcends everything else. I think that's how the masters can tell us that when final liberation comes, all of the other experiences that we have had just reveal themselves to have been nothing but the play of light and shadow. And all the sorrow and all the heartbreak and all the suffering and disappointment, it's not merely that the journey was worth it, is that it ceases even to exist. I've been meditating on that lately, and I have to say, I want to use the phrase, without much success. But nonetheless, it's deeply intriguing to me. You know, how can griefs, which even now can bring one to tears, or at least certainly can bring a constriction to the open flow of the divine in the heart, how can they actually cease to exist when one has experienced it? And yet, you know, to the small extent that sufficient time has passed and sufficient sadhana has been carried out, there are areas of heartbreak that are no longer heartbreaking. They're just necessary steps on the path. I used to really like mountaineering books and Everest stories, and now I've read a number of those kinds of stories, Himalayan ascents, and I've seen movies, and I'm sure many of you have too, documentaries and dramatizations of people in the howling wind, you know, freezing cold. And yet people do that more than once, you know, in an attempt to achieve what they want to achieve. And so, you know, that's so trivial compared to God realization. And even that kind of suffering is not as deep as other kinds of suffering that people go through. And yet every saint, every single saint, tells us that it just dissolves into bliss. Isn't that just extraordinary to contemplate? I try to think of it sometimes just literally dissolving into bliss. My limited drug experience, my LSD trip that did tell me that consciousness was everything, which was the first trip I ever took. I remember very little of it, except I do remember looking at the material world and watching it fragment before my eyes and turn into bright light. It wasn't accompanied by a corresponding state of bliss, but just the using my physical eyes to watch the physical world fragment. It didn't fragment completely, but pieces of it fragmented into light. It was Divine Mother's rather odd hippie 60s way of alerting me to a divine realization that I needed to know, which is this world and nothing in it, including ourselves, is what it seems. We're all just children of God, and that's where we're going. And we need to join hands and join hearts and join souls that we can bring ourselves and one another into that light. God bless you, my friends.